is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
If you see a player who you're like, oh, that player is a scholarship player, and you think probably a waste of time if I went out and recruited him, well, you know, you're never going to get the kids that you need to win at this level. And so I just think that you need to recruit with imagination when it comes to their basketball talent. You need to sort of, even if you think a kid might be too good, you have to kind of imagine ways that he might fall to you.
Jeff Geron is entering his ninth season as the head men's basketball coach at Suffolk University in Boston, while also serving as the assistant director of athletics. Over eight seasons, Geron has helped the Rams to new heights, highlighted by six consecutive winning seasons. Geron and Suffolk earned one of the biggest achievements an NCAA Division III program can as the 2019-2020 Sportsmanship Award honorees. That award is presented by the Collegiate Basketball Officials Association to the college or university, which in the judgment of the CBOA membership exemplifies the highest degree of sportsmanship, character, and ethics among their players, coaches, and spectators. Geron came to Suffolk after spending five seasons at the University of Rochester as an assistant coach. Jeff began his coaching career as an assistant at Skidmore College during the 2009-2010 season. As a four-year starting point guard at Rochester from 2004 to 2008, Geron helped the Yellow Jackets to the Division III NCAA tournament three times, including a spot in the 2005 National Championship game. Hey, Hoopheads, get your team ready for this season by shopping Dr. Dish's all-in sales event and receive an exclusive $3,000 off their top training solution, the CT Plus. Dr. Dish is here to help your players have no regrets, just results, and be all in this upcoming season with exclusive offers on their top shooting machines now during the Dr. Dish September all-in sales event. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Steve Moore, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Jeff Geron, men's basketball head coach at Suffolk University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome the head men's basketball coach at Suffolk University, Jeff Geron. Jeff, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball. What do you remember?
Yeah, so I grew up in upstate New York in a small town called Glenville, just outside of Albany. And my dad was a high school basketball coach, and I had an older brother who was 4 years older than me, who was really into the game when he was young. And so my earliest memories are just on this old asphalt patch of a court in my backyard that my dad had put down. Just my dad, my brother, and I just shooting, dribbling, playing all hours of the night. And you know, that's really on that court is where I developed my love for the game, and just tons of memories. You know, we'd play 2-on-1 versus my dad. We would play shooting games. We got horse. We got around the world. We had this old floodlight behind the house that would, you know, was on a motion detector, but the court was like just outside where the floodlight would pick up motion. So every like 30 minutes or an hour, I don't know what it was, but like the light would turn off and I was the youngest. So I would have to like run back towards the house and jump up and down in front of the floodlight, you know, to get the light back on the court so we could all keep shooting and playing. So those were the memories. It was very much a family thing. And yeah, cherished memories.
How competitive were you with your brother? Being 4 years behind him, were you ever able to kind of get to where you were close to being his peer, or was it always kind of just, hey, he was that far ahead of you physically?
He was always just sort of barely out of reach. And, you know, so I you had constant frustration when you're competing against him because you're losing all the time. And I wasn't a great loser as a kid. I was bratty and, you know, but, you know, that changed over time. But, yeah, I mean, I think in the end definitely helped develop competitiveness and striving for more, just constantly playing against someone who was bigger, faster, stronger than you.
Yeah, absolutely. How much were you and your brother around your dad's teams growing up?
I was around them all the time. So my brother had more interest. I was sort of a hoops junkie from day one. And so my dad coached at Bishop McGinn High School, which was in the city of Albany. And so he would bring me into his practices on the weekends and sometimes even weeknights. And, you know, I just sit around in the corner of the gym and watch those practices. I was the little kid sitting at the end of the bench as the water boy during the games. You know, I was really, you know, sort of my dad and his player's number one fan. And, so I took a love to it very, very early on. My brother was a better natural athlete than me, but just didn't have the same love for it, had other interests. And so, for whatever reason, it really stuck with me.
Who's the player on your dad's teams that you remember when you think about those times? Is there one kid that sticks out that maybe showed a special interest in you or that you really liked watching them play or just connected with them?
Yeah, there's so many. There's two in particular. Mike Grasso was a three-sport athlete. I think he ended up playing Division I baseball, but he was a point guard, a great athlete, just incredible handle. He would do things that like I just didn't think of with the basketball from a handle standpoint. And Steve Scambolari was another guy. He ended up playing and coaching at St. Rose, which is a Division II school in Albany, New York. Just like undersized two guard lefty, but just so smooth, filled it up. And yeah, obviously as a guard myself, just watching those two guys in particular, definitely took away a lot from both.
When did you start to take advantage of the fact that your dad had keys to the gym?
So, yeah, I mean, very early on, I guess, is the short answer. So I would, he coached my youth travel team. So, you know, we'd get to the gym early, we'd leave late. You know, now he's a head coach in Albany and I live in Glenville and there's 40 minutes away between, you know, the two spots as far as his coaching job. So I wasn't in the McGinn gym all day every day, but like certainly as he was coaching my travel teams, I was in the gym early and left late.
As you started to get up into high school and you think about your development as a player, what were some of the things that you yourself did to improve your game? Were you playing pick up? How much were you working on your game by yourself? Was your dad helping you through that process? Just what did you go about doing to become a better player during your high school years?
Yeah. So leading up to my high school years, it was an interesting situation. There was another kid in my town, Sam Zulo, who I grew up with. His dad was also a high school basketball coach at Shenandoah. And his dad ended up being a New York State Hall of Famer. At the high school level, won a state championship in the 80s. And so, you know, there's these two kids in a pretty small town on the outskirts of Albany whose dads were high school basketball coaches. So we just honestly played together all the time as kids. And so, unfortunately, he moved away going into high school. At that point in time, though, I'd already, you know, gotten pretty deep into AAU. And so, you know, the summers was a combination of individual work on my own in the backyard and AAU. AAU wasn't quite as year round back then as it is now, but, you know, all spring, certainly early summer, I was doing AAU mixed with individual workouts and then, you know, the high school season.
What's your favorite memory from being a high school basketball player?
Good question. My senior year, we won the sectional championship. You know, New York is a big state, so winning the sectional championship in Section 2, which is the Albany area, was a big deal for us. And our high school was not, and still to this day is not, a basketball powerhouse by any means. And so we had a pretty good group of guys in my class and the class below me, a couple good college players, and we ended up winning back-to-back sectional championships my senior year and then the year after I graduated. So kind of getting over the top at a school that, you know, didn't exactly have a track record of winning was a big deal.
When did playing college basketball get on your radar? Was that something that you had been thinking about from the time you were young, or did that come a little bit later on, maybe when you're a sophomore, junior in high school?
I think probably my sophomore year was when I realized that I thought it was a definitely attainable. I was a really late bloomer, and so I was very skilled because I cared a lot and I worked on my game a lot and I had great coaching, but I was incredibly small my freshman year of high school, like 5'3", like 120, like really, really small. And then my sophomore year, I grew a little bit height wise, but then, you know, was still just really skinny and was honestly really skinny even up to my senior year of high school. But, you know, sophomore year, I played varsity as a sophomore. I struggled with the physicality of it, but, you know, was skilled enough to kind of make it work. And then going in, you know, I had a really good junior high school season. It became pretty clear after my junior high school season that I was going to get recruited. You know, it was unclear at that point what level.
So what did that look like as you went into the process? When you look back now, and obviously you've been through it on the other side of it from a coaching standpoint, what do you remember about kind of how you looked at it as a player? Did your dad kind of walk you through and help you with the process? Just what was the mindset as you were going into that recruitment?
Yeah, I think I was just fortunate to have really good guidance and a really good supportive family through that whole process. And so, like, I just honestly never remember any sort of pressure from my family or anyone around me to play higher than the Division III level, or you know, just like the idea that if you're not getting a scholarship, that it's some sort of failure. And, you know, my dad's friends were all high school basketball coaches or college coaches. And so, like, I'm just around that perspective constantly as a kid. And so I always thought of Division III basketball as a high level. I would go down the street and watch games at Union College. Like, I probably saw more Division III college games as a high schooler than the average kid. And so I was always very interested in the Division III level. I had some sort of light Division II recruitment and light academic Division I recruitment during my junior year, but that tailed off pretty quickly. It was pretty clear by about the beginning of my senior year that I was going to be a Division III player. And you know, at that point, it just became about finding the right fit at the Division III level.
So you end up at Rochester, obviously really good academic school. Why Rochester? I mean, I'm beyond the obvious of they've had a great basketball tradition and obviously the academics are top notch, but what do you remember about making that decision? What kind of pushed you over the top?
I mean, that's really it, Mike. Like, it wasn't that complicated for me. I mean, those two things, I mean, elite academics, elite basketball, Division III level. The UAA was attractive to me at the time. I was a small town kid, and you know, the idea of playing in Chicago, Atlanta, New York City, Boston, you know, the rest of the bigger cities in that league was something that was cool. But the most important piece was just my visits. Like, I just loved my visits. I really got on with the guys. And in particular, there was an alum, Jeff Joss, who was from my area. he had just recently graduated. I never played with him, but he made it to a Final Four at Rochester 2 years before I entered the program, and knew his family well, knew Jeff well, and he had nothing but great things to say about his experience, and that really sealed the deal for me.
What were you thinking about when you went into school as far as academics and career? Was coaching at this point? Obviously, your dad's a coach. As you said, a lot of your dad's friends are coaches, so you've been around the coaching profession. Was coaching something that you were thinking about, or was it something that you were still just focused on being a player at that point?
Yeah, definitely was not thinking about it. You know, I had teammates who told me in college that I would be a coach, and I kind of pushed back against it. Like, I remember having those conversations. Like, I really love to play, and I was focused on playing at that time. It really didn't occur to me that I would coach as a career until much later on.
What was the adjustment like for you on the basketball court going from high school to college? What do you remember about that? And obviously, I guess that plays into kind of maybe conversations that you have with your incoming freshman now about, hey, this is some things that you got to be prepared for. So how do you think about that, or how did you experience that?
Yeah, so I had it's looking back on it, you know, luck plays such a role, but I had, you know, I don't want to say easy, but I had a nice transition to college. I mean, I played right off the bat, and for a number of reasons. I think the most important reason is that, you know, there was four rotation players from the previous year's team that was number one in the country for large stretches of the season that were hurt or had to take a leave of absence in the first semester. And so just immediately you come in and, you know, you have opportunity for playing time. And I think the other aspect of it is that I was mentally and emotionally sort of ready for college basketball when I got there. I see that as a pretty big challenge for some of my incoming guys nowadays, as a head coach. But you know, even if I was physically getting beaten up a little bit as a freshman, I think I thought the game maybe a little bit ahead of the curve for guys my age. And I could deal with the ups and downs a little bit better than guys my age. And, you know, I think all of that is just having grown up around coaches, to be honest. And, you know, I don't remember necessarily having specific conversations with my dad or other coaches in my life about, you know, handling the ups and downs of the game. But I just think from observing it and being around it so much. So when I got to Rochester, there was opportunity available in the backcourt, both on the ball and off the ball. And I could kind of play both spots. And I did. I first 7-8 games of the year, I started at point guard, and then I actually finished the season as the starting two guard. Once some of the other guys got back. So, you know, I had a good transition. But you know, it's just like so much of these things are luck. Like if those guys ahead of me didn't get hurt, like I wouldn't have played, you know?
You're 100% right. It's really interesting when you start talking about the different experiences. So we have, my son's going to be a senior in high school this year, and we have a player that he was a senior last year, graduated, and he went to a Division III school. And obviously, as you're making that decision, you're kind of trying to look at the roster, right, and figure out like, okay, who's coming back and where might I fit and this and that. And so I was talking to his dad the other day, and he said, yeah, he, you know, went to the school, and the guy who was they knew the starting point guard was going to be back, but they felt like, okay, he might have a chance to be a backup point guard based on just the way the rest of the roster looked. And then a couple of weeks before school started, they got a guy in who transferred, who's a point guard who now is going to supplant the starting point guard, it looks like. And so the starting point guard now becomes the backup point guard. And this kid from our school that went there with the idea of like, here's the depth chart, and now the depth chart has changed. And to your point, it's like you can get into a situation where luck sort of breaks against you or luck breaks for you. And a part of that, right, is you got to take advantage of whichever situation it is. Either you persevere through the tough luck, or you take advantage of the luck that you did get and kind of seize that opportunity by the horns and really jump in there and do it. Sounds like that's what you were able to do. And I'm sure those are conversations that you're having with your guys as they're coming in the door now here for their first year as freshmen, and they're getting acclimated to school. And of course, the nice part, which we can talk about at some point too, you guys got the 8 days of time that you can get with them in the gym a little bit out in the off season, which you guys never had at the Division III level. But just tell me a little bit about, I know we're jumping ahead, but tell me a little bit about how you kind of maybe use your own experiences to help your guys. And obviously now you've had experience as a head coach, but just what do you talk to your freshmen about as they're coming in terms of the transition, both academically, athletically, socially?
Yeah. Yeah. So I, you know, in terms of using my own playing experience, like, so I started off ahead of the curve, right, as a freshman in terms of opportunity and playing time and all that. But then, like, it's funny, when I was a senior, I sprained my knee prior to the season, so I missed some of the preseason. But I was healthy by the time games started, and sort of expected to just return to my starting role as point guard. And was effectively beaten out for the spot by another guy. And so I've gone now, like, in my career from a freshman who's starting on a really good team to a senior who's coming off the bench on a really good team. And I just think that experience in both situations allows me to relate to players on the team now who, you know, are dealing with the whole range of issues that players go through in regards to their role. And so, I think I have some empathy maybe for both sides of the coin. I think that's something I try to do all the time as a head coach, is remember that I was young once too. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, you'll see a young player doing things that are actively working against his own self-interest, and it drives you up the wall as a coach. And yet at the same time, you need to, like, sit back and remember that, like, you did those things,
right?
Like, as a player, like, you know, no one's immune to this stuff. And so, you know, you're in the position you're in as a head coach to help that young person navigate it. And, so yeah, all those experiences, I mean, I just feel like all those experiences as a player are so useful to handling any range of conversation like that.
What are some things that you see guys doing early on that you notice, like, yeah, I've seen this before, this guy's really trying too hard, or he's doing this or that? What are some of those things that you see?
The obvious one is just being just too outcome oriented, just focusing entirely on, you know, for young guys, whether or not they're playing. And it's sometimes is such a shock to these incoming freshmen that, you know, they're not going to play. Or if they are going to play, they're going to play a role that's dramatically different than what they're used to in high school. And I think it is our responsibility as head coaches in the recruiting process to try to prepare players for that transition. But it's also hard. It's a recruiting process, and you're trying to entice players to come to your school to help make your program better. So it's difficult. It's not that you're ever misleading kids. It's just that, you know, you highlight the positive things in the recruiting process. But I just think if you can insert a healthy dose of realism into the recruiting process, you can help manage some of those issues after the kids are on board. And so, yeah.
One of the things that you said earlier that I found interesting, and it's sort of a conversation that we've had a couple times with some Division III head coaches, is you talked about how you had been very familiar with Division III basketball. But we all know that the knowledge out there of Division III basketball on the behalf of high school players and high school parents isn't always up to that level. When you're talking to kids, how many kids that you're actively recruiting will tell you, hey, I've never seen a Division III game, or I have almost no experience with it? Like, do you run into that a lot or no?
So I used to run into it a lot. Since I moved to Boston and now coach at Suffolk, it's a little bit less now. There's just so many Division III schools out here.
Yeah.
And so I just think kids have more of an opportunity to get out and see a Division III game. But I would imagine that in some parts of the country, it's still 100% true that most high school kids have not seen a Division III game in person. And that is too bad. I think that it would help those players in terms of their self-awareness to get out and see how good the game is at this level. It would help them in the recruiting process. It would help them in their own individual growth.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, I think when you go and you watch a Division III game, you see how good the skill level is of the players that are playing Division III. And I would tell people all the time, like, people have no idea and understanding when you go and you sit at like a youth tournament or you sit at a AAU tournament and you hear different people talk and this and that. And there's obviously so much misinformation out there with social media and kids posting this and that and the other thing. And you want to tell people, hey, have you been to one of these games? Have you gone and seen how good the level of play is at Division III? And I think there's just a lot of people that are unfortunately unaware of it. And to your point, I think that if you're in an area like we're here in Cleveland where we have lots of Division III schools, so I think there's probably more knowledge here. Obviously, the state of Ohio has tons of Division III, so there's a lot more, just like you said, where kids are familiar with it. But it's still interesting, even that, the number of kids, just to get, because again, what do you see? Everybody wants to post their Division I or their Division II, their scholarship offers and this and that. And I think people sometimes, again, forget that, man, Division III basketball is really, really good. And obviously, you've spent most of your entire career there. And so that's where your experience lies. Let's talk a little bit about your playing career after you graduate. So what's the plan? When you graduate, is coaching and you're on your radar at that point, or are you still, hey, I'm going to get a chance to go play overseas? We can talk about that in a second, but just what was your mindset when you graduated?
Yeah. So my playing career overseas was super brief. It was effectively like an extended tryout. I was in Eindhoven, Netherlands, and really was there for 2.5-3 months before coming back. Things just didn't work out. And so when I got back, honestly, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I was not rushing to get into coaching. I took a job as a paralegal in the Albany area and started taking my LSATs and submitting law school applications. I was a political science English major at Rochester. My friends at the time had, you know, moved on to Boston, New York City, DC, working nice jobs. And probably a part of me at that time just felt a little pressure to kind of utilize the degree. And, you know, we all know first year coaching opportunities are not always the best, financial gambits, right?
And so they're not super lucrative. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so I think there was some pressure that I felt a little bit early on to just sort of, you know, do something different. And yet while I was doing all of that, sort of preparing myself for law school, I was living at home and Luke Flickersey, who was an assistant of mine at Rochester, was now, after I graduated, the head coach at Skidmore College, which is right down the road from me. And he's on the verge of his third year. He's begun to really sort of turn the tide of his program. And he asked me to join the coaching staff. And I can't remember exactly. I'm not sure if it was, I think I was getting paid a little bit, but it was not much, but it was an opportunity to coach. And so I did it. And, you know, that year was, you know, talking about luck earlier. I mean, that year changed my entire life. I mean, if Luke wasn't there and didn't offer me that opportunity, I honest to God don't know if I end up coaching as a career. I can truly say I was prepared to just go to law school. But he gave me the opportunity. Skidmore has a turnaround season. And then in another event that you just can't predict, my college coach, Mike Neer, who won 600 plus games in a national championship and is sort of a legend in Division III circles, retires. And so, you know, no one in the Rochester basketball alumni family could have predicted that or believed that. But
all of a sudden the job's open, and Luke was right on the back end of a terrific turnaround at Skidmore, and he gets the job at Rochester, and days later he gives me a call and asks if I want to join him and take the graduate assistant spot on staff. And it's and now I have this opportunity to really fast track my coaching career, where I'm joining one of the best Division III programs with room to grow because there's a full-time position on staff. And I've only been in coaching 1 year, and you can start to look ahead and see how this path might work for you in terms of ultimately becoming a head coach one day. And so, again, I just can't come back to this enough. Like that, that was just lucky. Right? Like I don't know how else to describe it. I often struggle when, like, my assistants or younger coaches ask me, like, you know, well, how did you decide how to go about your
those thousands of emails that you sent out? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no. And I didn't do that. And almost there's like, you know, there's like survivor's guilt in a way, but I was fortunate because I was a player in the program. I was fortunate because Luke did a great job at the right time. And I was fortunate because my college coach retired, and all of a sudden I wind up in a place where if I work hard and keep my head down and do the right things, I have a reasonable path towards becoming a head coach fairly quickly. And that's not everybody gets the same breaks.
All right. I have two questions related to what we just talked about there. One, going back to the very beginning of the decision to take that job with Luke at Skidmore, what was the conversation like with your parents? Obviously, your dad is in coaching. He knows that it may not be the most lucrative job, especially not at the beginning. So you go through and you have this degree from Rochester, great institution. As you said, your friends are all getting jobs in other places. I'm sure they're making a lot more money in their first year than what you were going to make at Skidmore. So what was that conversation like with your parents? Were they immediately supportive and understanding? Was it a difficult conversation? What do you remember about that?
My parents have been supportive every step of the way. So there was never a difficult conversation with my parents in regards to taking a job that might be or not might be financially lucrative. They, from day one, have told me to do what I want to do and follow your passions, do what you love. And so nothing was ever difficult. I can tell you the Skidmore decision wasn't difficult because, you know, I was still sort of straddling two decisions at that point, right? So I took the job at Skidmore not knowing that I was going to be in coaching. I still firmly believed at that time that I was going to law school. The challenging decision for me was, once Luke got the job at Rochester, whether or not to essentially at that point go 2 feet into coaching.
Right.
That was the real choice for me. And that was hard. And I actually sort of took some time, and now it's like, you know, it seems crazy because it's my profession and it's what I love to do. And I'm happy that, like, a younger, dumber version of myself made the right choice. But, like, you know, I did take a long time to make that choice. And I probably frustrated Luke with the amount of time I took to make that choice. So, sorry, Luke.
What did you like about coaching? Because clearly, when it's not on your radar and you love the game of basketball, but the coaching side of it wasn't something that you were really looking at or studying. So when you get in there that first year and you get around it and you get involved in it, what did you like about it initially? And then maybe what were the things that you had reservations about that caused you to maybe take that extra time before you decided, hey, I'm going to jump all in on this?
Yeah, there was no reservations about coaching. The thing I realized instantly that I missed is just the locker room, the intensity of the locker room, right? And for good and bad, and what that can do for a team and what that can do for relationships. And, you know, I'm a competitive guy. And so just, you know, you sort of instantly realize that, okay, I missed this. I know I'm not playing anymore, but just in terms of the intensity and being on a team and improving over the course of a season, all of that stuff I just missed. What was the other part of the question?
So the second part would be that when you made that decision, and you get in there, what was it that you loved? I mean, what was it that you're like, man, this is the thing that's going to push me over the top. This is why I want to go in and stay with the coaching.
I think it was a series of conversations with Luke. I don't think it was any one moment, but I think towards the end of the season, in various ways, Luke communicated to me that, like, he thought I could be pretty good at it. And, you know, that was neat to hear. And so, you know, you start to grow confidence in your voice. And, you know, so I can't remember any singular moment, but just sort of, you know, the belief that, hey, this is something that maybe I have a little bit of a natural knack for because of my upbringing, because of some fortunate experiences I've had as a player, because I've been around a bunch of great coaches growing up. I just, you know, maybe this, you know, the thought sort of occurs to you that maybe this is sort of in my blood.
What did you learn during your time as an assistant in terms of what it takes to be the kind of assistant that eventually you might want to hire when you're a head coach? What did you learn about being an assistant coach?
I think the biggest lesson is being a self-starter. And that was something that Luke talked a lot with me about. And, you know, there's so much responsibility, that, you know, a coaching staff needs to divvy up on a day-to-day basis, and just everything simply can't be communicated from the head coach down. It can't be a series of directives. Assistant coaches have to be proactive. They have to be themselves. They need to, you know, not wait for specific instructions. And so just becoming a self-starter, seeing processes through to the end. Those were conversations I had a lot early on.
How did you go about developing your X's and O's? Obviously, you're learning a lot from Luke, and you're observing him, and you're watching him, and you guys are having conversations in the coach's office and wherever else. But what did you do to develop yourself and to help you to think the game better? Where were you going to get that kind of information? Are you watching other games, college games, NBA, high school? Are you going in clinics? Just what was your process for improving in that area?
Well, you're improving every day on the job if you're doing scouting reports, right? Because every time you scout a team, you're diving deep into what they're doing, and you're learning new things. And I definitely remember in that first year at Skidmore, just, you know, because as a player at Rochester, you know one system. And I played for one coach at Rochester. And Luke was good for me, too, at that time in my career, because he had worked and played for some different coaches who saw the game in different ways, and was willing to adapt his style to the strengths of the team in any particular year. And so just, you know, I only worked for one head coach, you know, Luke. And so, but he, in those 6 years that I was with him, we actually played a variety of different styles. So learning different styles through him, learning different styles through, you know, conducting scouting reports. And I think later on, then once you sort of have already gotten somewhat deep into it, then you start sort of seeking it out on your own. And nowadays, I mean, just the internet, right?
Right,
I mean,
absolutely.
You can find anything you want on the internet, for better or worse. And sometimes I actually think that's a challenge for young coaches now, because there's so much information out there, and kind of, I imagine it's probably a challenge for young coaches nowadays to sort of distill down their style, given that there's so much knowledge out there. And I almost feel lucky that I came up at a time where I didn't know.
I got you.
Aware of all the different styles. And so I knew sort of the things that I knew. And maybe that's sometimes a better thing.
That is a good point. And you can go, I mean, it's like anything, right? I mean, you can go and find a million different things that you're like, hey, this is awesome. I'd love to be able to use this, whether it's just from watching tape, whether it's from reading a book, or I know I've said this before, but I tend to be one of those people that I'll see something, whether it's an X's and O thing, or it might be a leadership thing, or it just might be something like personal development. I'll grab it. I'll be like, oh man, I'm going to try this, or let's do this with the team. And I'll be excited about it for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then I'll see something else, and I'll jump to that next thing instead of just saying, okay, what am I really all about? Whether it's, again, as a basketball philosophy, or whether it's just in my own development, I'll get kind of caught up in like this 2-3 week. All right, I'm super excited. And then I'm moving on to the next thing. And I think I've gotten better at that. When I was younger, I was definitely much more like that. And to your point, it's now just so easy to be able to find stuff no matter where you want to go on the internet. You can just, and it's all, and I mean, there's a ton, as you said, there's a ton of good things out there. It's just a matter of how do you comb through all that and figure out what exactly I'm going to use. So to that point, how did you go about kind of collecting and gathering things as you started to put your thoughts together where you might want to eventually take over your own program and become a head coach? How did you kind of organize what you were learning? Did you have Google Drive? Did you put things in the old-fashioned three-ring binder? Did you have a shoebox where you just collected? How did you go about putting together the things that you felt were going to help you if you eventually became a head coach?
Yeah, I don't know that I did a great job of that. I did not have the old three-ring binder. I did not have Google Drive. I when I got the job at Suffolk, I carried over a lot of the things that we did at Rochester. And so that's the stuff that I knew, like, intimately. Like, I knew, and we ran sort of a Princeton hybrid, and a lot of Princeton actions in the half court, a lot of sort of spread ball screen and drive and kick in transition. And like, that's the stuff that I knew. And that's really largely what we've continued to use here at Suffolk. And yes, we've tweaked every year, but that skeleton has really remained the same. And so, maybe I'm not curious enough, but,
if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, Jeff.
I've carried over a lot of that stuff. And listen, you know, part of it is I like this. I like the style. I Princeton stuff, spread ball screen. I played point guard. I played off the ball. It's a system that I think I would have enjoyed playing in as a player. Space, floor, room to drive. That's what we do now. But, nowadays with Twitter and everything, you can just bookmark stuff, right? So I guess nowadays, I do have a pretty extensive, bookmark library on Twitter, but,
it's hard to curate that stuff. It really is.
What I knew. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
It's hard to curate all that stuff. I mean, I'll find myself going through and, like you, I got a ton of bookmarks of things and I'm like, oh yeah, I want to check that out or do that. And it'll catch your eye. And then it's like, okay, you got to do that. But then you also got to figure out, when can I actually go back through this and figure out what can I incorporate into what we do, right? It's one thing to see something, be like, oh, that looks great. And then it's another thing to dive as deep into it as you need to be able to incorporate that with your team or your program, depending upon what you're looking at.
Right. And you also need to know all the ways to fix it when it goes wrong.
Okay, there you go.
So if you got too much stuff in there, you just...
Hey, Hoopheads Nation. Whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, 3-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder, Vlad Moldovanu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, HoopHeads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial.
All right, take me back to the interview process when you get the job at Suffolk. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, I remember going into it being a little bit tentative just because the track record of Suffolk as a basketball program wasn't great when I interviewed. And so I went into the process maybe a little bit skeptical, but I was really blown away by the process. It was a 2-day sort of very professional, very thorough interview. And during the interview, I actually learned about plans for the expansion of the athletic department, the expansion of resources towards athletics that were, you know, set to occur in the years ahead. And so I felt like, you know, I was sort of maybe at that point in on something that maybe others didn't know about, and really impressed by our athletic director, Kerry McConnell, who's spent some time at Rochester, and that's probably why I was offered an interview. But he just really laid out a vision for the department, and he was upfront about where the program was at the time, but he also had a strategy for hiring, you know, young coaches in my position and our other head coaching position in the years ahead that has really paid off for the entire department. And so I was blown away by the interview. I knew pretty much by the time I had driven all the way back to Rochester after the interview that if offered the job, I was going to take it. There's so many things about the university that are attractive. I mean, it's a terrific school in the middle of Boston. You can walk to the TD Garden. You can walk to the Boston Harbor. You can walk to the Boston Common. I mean, we're just really in such a great part of the city. The academics are very strong. It's a great business school, great law school. And there's tons of kids playing hoop in New England and in the Northeast. And I just felt immediately like this is a place that I could recruit to, and also an exciting place to live and work. So I pretty much knew by the time I got home from the interview that if offered, I would accept the job.
Did you have questions for them? I often think what's interesting is clearly they obviously have questions for you, but going into that job, what questions did you have for them? Was it about the commitment to the program based on sort of the history?
I think so. It was Kerry was a new AD when I got hired. He was only 1 year in, I think, maybe two. And so, I kind of wanted to hear what the plan was for the department and what resources I would have. And, you know, by the end of the interview, I was firmly convinced that I would have enough to be able to run a successful program.
When you got there and you looked around, what's the first week or two on the job like? What are some of the things that you immediately said, these are my first priority? Obviously, you want to get in connection with your players and talk to them, guys who are returning, and you got to start getting out and thinking about recruiting. But what were some of the administrative things that kind of you wanted to take care of that you had to get a handle on right away? You're like, hey, we got to do these things if we want to be successful.
Yeah, I had to do a lot of research on the school, and while, you know, Rochester is in the Northeast, it's closer to Ohio than it is to Boston. You know, it's almost Midwestern in a lot of ways, and so it did feel like a regional shift for me to come to Boston, and I did not know much about the league or the players in the program. I had not seen them play, so I just think immediately you have to familiarize yourself with certainly the student athletes on roster, but then also the institution. Like, the first thing that you have to do when you take over a program is get out there and recruit. And
try to find some better players. And, you know, you have to know what you're recruiting to. So I had to dive deep into the university and find out where the university drew its students from, and, you know, just try to become an expert so that, you know, when I'm giving tours or I'm speaking to a family or to a kid on the phone, you know, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, without that knowledge of the institution and knowing what you're selling is clearly key. And obviously the longer you're there, the more that develops. But to your point, coming in from outside of the regional area where you're not familiar maybe with those players, you're not familiar with the schools that you're playing against, you're not familiar with the area of what you're trying to sell. So yeah, I can see we're getting caught up on that. It was pretty immediate. What do you remember about the conversations with the returning players? What were some of the things that you wanted to get across to them in terms of what you expected from the program and your philosophy? What did you share with them in those first conversations?
I think that just there would be an increased expectation in terms of their commitment level over the course of the year. Those were the conversations early on. I mean, you can only change so much in your first year, and you're also going in not quite sure how many of the returning players will want to be a part of your new program and how many of the returning players you'll want to be a part of your program. And so you don't quite know those things, but you do want to set some clear expectations. And so, yeah, I remember a mixed bag of conversations where I sort of would lay out what the year-round commitment to basketball would look like for the future of Suffolk, and you know, having really mixed reactions from the players in terms of, you know, yeah, that excites me, or you know what, like I'm all set, coach. Like I'm good.
Yeah, absolutely. Stepping over from that assistant chair to the head coaching position, what do you think was the biggest adjustment for you? Does one thing stand out as this is the biggest change from being an assistant to being a head coach? I mean, there's probably a million things, but what's the main one big thing that you'd say, hey, this is the biggest difference, and you noticed it right away?
Yeah, the biggest difference for me, just the volume of decisions that you're making. You know, everything from what the team's having for lunch, what time the bus is leaving. Are we taking vans or a bus? Are we getting a post-game meal? What time are we going into the locker room pre-game? How are we going to handle our warm-ups? Who's ordering the gear? Like, it just, you know, I could go on and on, right? But it's the volume of those small decisions. Some of them are basketball decisions, but a lot of them are organizational and administrative, and it can make you weary by the end of the day sometimes, to the point where you're not your best by the time practice starts, right? And so just trying to get a grip on that, and trying to pace yourself, use your summers well to get ahead of some stuff. That piece of it, kind of the emotional toll and just the sheer volume of things that you need to make decisions on, you can't replicate it. You can't prepare for it as an assistant.
Did you fully realize it or no? I mean, did you, when you're watching Luke and you're there as an assistant, are you aware of all those decisions that he's making, and you just kind of take them, I don't want to say take them lightly, but you're just not really processing how much thought goes into those decisions? Or are you maybe just not even aware the decisions were being made, if that question makes any sense?
No, it makes sense. In short, no, you're not aware. And I think if I was aware, I would have tried to maybe prepare myself more. I don't know how I would have done that, but you're not aware of the emotional toll, so to speak. Like this win or loss goes on your record, right? you know, just that stuff early on. And early on, you can get caught up in win loss. And listen, like, not that, you know, you don't anymore, but like you learn how to win better and lose better as you go on. But yeah, I don't think I was fully aware of the emotional tone. I don't think I was aware of the volume of decisions. The other thing is that, you know, I just think that this is a tremendous strength for Luke. He's very organized. He's, I never felt that in the office as his assistant, like, oh man, this guy's struggling under the weight of decisions right now. Whereas my early assistants probably were.
Clearly, after you get the job, one of the next biggest priorities is, hey, we got to start recruiting and getting the type of players that we want in our program. So even not going back maybe necessarily to that first class, but just in general, what's your philosophy on recruiting? How do you go about putting together the list of players that you're going to recruit from? And just maybe walk me through the process of what it's like from identifying a player to actually getting a guy to commit.
Yeah, I think as a Division III head coach, you're sort of constantly trying to strike that balance between, like, can you get the kid and also not selling yourself short?
Right.
And so, you know, get ability is kind of the best ability in recruiting, right? Like at the Division III level, can this player get into your school? Is he a good financial fit for your school? That will rule out far more players than any other factor, like those two things. And so you need to do some digging early on as you recruit players and you recruit their families about, you know, is there a likelihood here that Suffolk is going to be a good fit for this family? And then at the same time, you know, you have to balance that with you can't quite do that with just the basketball side. So if you see a player who you're like, oh, that player is a scholarship player, and you think like, I don't know, like probably a waste of time if I went out and recruited him. Well, you know, you're never going to get the kids that you need to win at this level. And so I just think that, you know, you need to recruit with imagination when it comes to their basketball talent. You need to sort of, even if you think a kid might be too good, you have to kind of imagine ways that he might fall to you. And at the same time, you're sort of doing your homework furiously behind the scenes to figure out, well, would this kid even say yes to Suffolk anyway? Or are we not the right academic fit? Are we not the right financial fit? Are we not the right social cultural fit? So it's a constant sort of balance.
AAU versus high school basketball. Do you have a preference watching a kid and evaluating them? Obviously, the one thing that we always hear on the pod is AAU. It allows you to go and see a lot of kids in a shorter period of time, which clearly you can't do on the high school level. But when it just comes to strictly evaluating a kid and getting a feel for what they may or may not be able to do as a basketball player in your program, what are the pros and cons of watching them play with their high school team versus watching them play with their AAU team?
Yeah, the pros of AAU are just what you said. It's just streamlined. You see more kids in a shorter period of time. And if I had to choose one, I would choose AAU for that reason, because time is scarce. But you know, I think the pro of the high school experience is you sort of, you know, get to see a player in a role, whatever that role is. And so sometimes, you know, out here in New England, we recruit often from, you know, prep schools that where the Division III players might be the seventh or eighth guy coming off the bench, and they're clearly good enough to play at your level, but you know, they're not better than the scholarship players that are playing ahead of them. And so I do think that there's some value in seeing them in their high school setting, seeing how they respond to coaching, seeing how they respond to maybe a reduced role. So you can't really paint it with a broad brush, because there's some great AAU coaches and the, you know, there's some bad high school programs, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to pin down, but I do think that with high school teams, you can kind of see the kid maybe a little bit more in his natural setting, and you can maybe evaluate some of the non-basketball things a little bit better, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. What's one of the number one intangibles that you look for?
Just
you know, I just being able to respond on the court and to things that don't go your way, to things that do go your way. You know, we just, you know, we've sort of stolen from Jay Wright in that regard. Just, you know, the whole concept of attitude. Jay Wright's first job was at Rochester, by the way. So I'm a huge fan of his, and I've had a chance to meet him a couple times and be on Zooms with him where he's discussing basketball. I'm not close with him by any means. He has no idea who I am, but but from afar, I've admired and you know, certainly his whole concept of attitude, and just the idea of, you know, we want to be thought out in terms of how we respond to stuff on the court, and we want to be we want to be able to handle things that don't go our way well, and we want to handle situations that do go our way well. And, you know, we want to gain a competitive advantage in that category. And so, yeah, we do look for that in our high school recruits. I think certainly if you can start further down that line, you know, the better off you're going to be. Right. But, you know, it, like everything else, it's a balance. You have to balance. Can you get the kid, and is the kid talented enough to make your program better, and does he love your school? So there's all that stuff, but you know, we are watching kind of the immediate responses on the court.
All right. So once you get a kid that you feel like fits and you get them on campus, they commit, they're in your program, and now you're in a practice setting with your team, what does it look like in terms of helping them to develop that skill of being able to react to things, good and bad? What are you guys talking about in practice? How are you developing that once they're part of your program?
It's a lot of film work, because oftentimes these things happen quickly. And sometimes it can just be like a look, or, you know, like a palms up thing, right? Like ref makes a call you don't like, player puts his palms up, rolls his eyes, like that. That's it, right? Like you're trying to get rid of that. You're trying to get them onto the next play. You're trying to help them have more of a sort of a warrior mentality on the court. And it's not easy, right? It's not easy. You have to train these responses. And so so you have to sort of put them in those situations in practice. And so you you know, you do the thing as coaches where you don't make calls in practice, right? You intentionally swallow the whistle to force your guys to play through some stuff. You do that from time to time. You play out time and score situations as much as possible to put them in as many pressurized situations, and you got to create some sort of consequence to them so that, you know, they're taken seriously. It's all of that, right? But I think oftentimes, I mean, when we're in the office one-on-one with the guys looking at film, you know, we try not to overload them with film, but we'll often have a few clips that are totally basketball related. Like, hey, you made the wrong read here. Hey, your footwork is wrong here. But we almost always try in one-on-one settings to include some sort of non-basketball, a mistake response, or, you know, an example of a guy being a great teammate. You know, you want to point out the positive too. So, you know, all those things, but it's no one thing, but all those things accumulate.
How often are you doing those one-on-one film sessions with guys?
I think for, certainly for our rotation players, once a week. You know, for our non-rotation guys, we have less film for them. So you try as much as possible to get clips from practice. But the reality is, certainly as you get later in the season, it's probably one time a week individually with your rotation guys.
And when you have them in there and you're talking to them, how long is that process?
Depends on the kid, depends on the day, right? You know, in general, the philosophy is not to keep it long. Like student athletes at Suffolk, like, they just have a lot on their plate. They're living in the city. They obviously have their academics. They have basketball. Many of them work part-time jobs in addition to help make the cost of living in Boston, you know, more affordable. And so, you're not trying to wear them down. And I am constantly like sort of mindful of just the toll of the entire season, right? You don't want burnout. But you know, once a week for 10 to 15 minutes with a player, I think is enough to sort of reinforce the points that you're making over the course of a season without risking burnout.
Makes sense. Makes total sense. And I think that's another thing that I'm sure that when you start talking with high school players and high school parents and the amount of time commitment, I'm not sure that there's a lot of people that really understand the amount of time that guys put in, both again with the basketball, but as you said, also when you're at a great academic school, the time that you're putting in with the academics. How do you handle that from a practice standpoint? Let's just break it down: preseason and then in season. How long you guys typically practice, and then what's your practice? When during the day do you usually practice? At what time of day, or does it vary based on gym availability and schedule? And just how do you guys go about organizing the practices?
Yeah, so like early on preseason, most of our practices are 2 hours, and then as you get into first semester games, we might cut it down to about 90 minutes, and then as we get into the second semester, we probably stick around 90 minutes for January, and then you know you get into February and March, and those practices become maybe something closer to an hour on the court, plus individual skill, plus film, plus lift, kind of mixed in throughout. So that's the broad scope of the year. I've had to get much more creative at Suffolk, and certainly sort of in the COVID era,
yeah,
or post-COVID era with practice scheduling. We have grad students in the program. Grad school here at Suffolk is a huge strength of the university, and it's not something that we've particularly sought out as part of any sort of pre-planned recruiting strategy. But just the reality is, because our grad programs are very strong, and because a lot of kids in New England would like to ultimately move and live in Boston after graduation, we get a lot of outreach, and that's been great, right, in some ways, but also created some real challenges for us. And so one of those challenges is just playing practice, because most of our grad school classes are at night. Most of our undergrad classes are during the day. So our practices tend to be early afternoon, maybe late afternoon. But they're far more irregular maybe now than I would like. I in an ideal world, we're practicing, 3 to 5 every day. We rarely have consecutive days now where we're at the same time. And that's a bit of a challenge. And often we have a guy or two maybe coming late or leaving early. And listen, that's part of D3. That's true anywhere. That's not just Suffolk. That's not just COVID. But we're trying to manage those challenges and trying to maximize the time when we have the entire team on the court in practice as much as possible.
What does your practice planning process look like in terms of what you're actually doing on the floor at practice? Do you like to follow a set sort of itinerary, for lack of a better way of saying it, where you defense first, then offense, transition? Just how do you organize your practices, and what does your practice planning process look like?
Yeah, the practice planning process, generally early in the day, I'll make some first draft of it and get it out to my assistant. And then by the time we're both in the office together, maybe, late morning, early afternoon, we just go over the practice and kind of finalize it. I've had different sort of structures of practice over the years. I don't know that there's any particular structure in terms of defense first, skill work first. This past year, we were definitely more of a defensive team, and it became pretty clear after 4 or 5 games that, we were going to earn our money on the defensive side of the ball. And so this past year, we definitely were heavier in terms of defensive skill work, defensive uh,
teamwork earlier on in practice and then flowing from there to offensive stuff. But I am flexible with that, kind of depending on the team, depending on the year.
How do you balance out? I know this is one of the things that a question that I often like to ask, just because I think different coaches have different thoughts about it. But when you're in your actual practice setting, how much do you balance out coaching, meaning, I guess, talking with the players versus keeping the action flowing? I think there's, I don't know if it's necessarily a debate, but I think it's one of the things that coaches are always talking about is how much do I try to get my point across? Do I point out something we did well, something that we need to work on, a mistake that was made, versus I don't want to be blowing that whistle or stepping in and interrupting all the time, because guys need to be able to play with the flow. And as you talked about earlier, they got to be able to play through mistakes and have a response to that in a positive way. So how do you balance out just how much you're talking throughout a practice?
Yeah, I do think that that's a common mistake for young coaches, and I still make it. You just find yourself talking too much, and you know, you know it for sure when you look around and you like the eye contact isn't great, and it's like, all right, like I need to shut up. But you also realize over time that, you know, like we film practices, and so like I'll have time after practice to make teaching points with the players, and that's a benefit of technology nowadays. And so I've learned that over time and done a better job of it, and tried to keep my coaching to sort of sound bites during practice as much as possible. But yeah, I'm sure, you know, if you ask my players, some of them would say I still talk too much. But I do think it's something that you have to be mindful of and try to avoid over talking for sure.
Well, let's talk about the leadership piece within your team in terms of your players. How do you think about leadership and helping your players to develop the leadership qualities that we know that good teams need to have leaders in the locker room and on the floor? So how do you give your guys the space to be able to develop as leaders? What are some of the things you do?
Yeah, you know, when it comes to captains, like we're pretty specific with the team that when we talk about our captains, you know, these are not the only guys that can exhibit leadership. And I think one of the things that we try to do is just define all the different ways that you can lead. And, you know, everyone has in their mind the thought of, you know, the vocal leader that, you know, rallies effort and inspires teammates. And, you know, some guys are capable of that. And some guys think they're capable of that and aren't very good at that. And others are comfortable leading quietly, leading by example. You know, you also need followers too, right? Like everybody can't be leading. And so I don't know that I have any one singular approach. It's clear that you need good leaders on your team. And I try to incorporate as many of our upperclassmen in that leadership as possible, try to inspire them to consider themselves as leaders, and then identify that, hey, leading can look like a lot of different things. And so, again, I'm not sure it's any one singular approach, but you're trying to help them understand that leadership can look like a lot of different things, and they're all important. And that, you know, without it, we're not going to get anywhere fast. And so I don't know if that's a good response. Probably an area that I could do a little bit better at, but we certainly don't have like a leadership training program. I know some coaches do a much better job with that stuff.
I think what I hear you saying, and I think it's true, is you have to me, what's always important is that, you know, no matter what you do with leadership, I feel like you have to make sure that there's space for guys to be leaders. In other words, it can't, you know, you've been around probably programs, and I've been around places where, you know, the coach is really the only voice. And I think that's becoming less and less. I think coaches are much more aware of at this point, you know, including players and decision-making and that kind of thing, and just what you were talking about. But I've certainly been around places where just, you know, coaches might talk about leadership, but then they don't ever give their players room to be able to actually, you know, step up and take the lead. And I think that that to me is what I hear you saying, is that there are opportunities within your program for guys to lead, and you're talking to them about that. And to me, that's really, I think, where the secret sauce of leadership lies, whether or not you do it in a formal way or a more informal way. I think you're going to develop leaders. And obviously at the Division III level, the leadership is important, not just during the season, but also in the off season, just because of the limited contact that you guys can have in the off season. So I guess that leads into what do you do with your players as the season ends and school is ending and they're going off to the summer for whatever they're doing with their internships, they're, you know, going back home or whatever they may be doing. How do you approach the summer with them in terms of giving them an idea of, hey, here's some things that you should be thinking about going into the summer and then consequently heading into the following season? How do you approach the summer with them?
Yeah. So this is an area where I'm excited for the extra days outside of season. So we're going to save a couple of our extra days for postseason this year. I've always felt like our year-end meetings could be more productive, especially when it comes to, you know, identifying, you know, basketball things you want your guys to improve on. You know, you can have a great conversation with those kids, but if they don't really have an understanding, let's say you want, you know, a post player to improve his footwork, his reverse pivot series, right? You know, like how do you work on that on your own? Because during the summer, you can't always rely upon having a coach in the gym with you. And so, like, if you want to get better at it, you have to work at it every day. And how can you reasonably work on that on your own, given limited resources that you might have during the summer? Some kids have tons of resources during the summer. Some kids don't, right? And so I just think using those year-end conversations to identify a couple skills to improve, and then having a conversation with the player about, you know, gym access that he has during the summer and, you know, potential friends that he might have to work out with, or teammates even better. And then, okay, once you're on the court, like what can you do to improve those things? What does a good individual workout for you look like? And so that's, we've always had the conversation. We've never been able to sort of get on the court postseason. So that's something that I'm looking forward to this year in terms of like the strength and conditioning piece in the off season. I might be setting the bar too low here, but like with the Division III level, like I'm okay with my guys doing anything that they're going to do consistently. And so we have a strength coach here, and he does put together a workout for our guys for the summer months. But, you know, as I said earlier, some guys have access to strength coaches that they use during the off season. Some guys don't. Some guys have access to a weight room. Some guys don't. And so I think you have to be realistic at this level about the constraints that your players are facing in the off season in terms of getting into the gym, improving their body. And you have to work within those constraints. And so we certainly, if our guys don't have a plan and they need something to do, we'll give them the plan that our strength coaches put together. If they come to me and they say they're working out with, you know, someone, some strength coach from their hometown, and we talk a little bit about what the program looks like and how often the player is going to do it, then, you know, I'll sign off on that. You know, if a player really doesn't have, you know, a gym that he can reliably go to, then, you know, the conversation shifts towards, all right, well, what's some body weight exercises? What, you know, what are some different things we can do, you know, without some advanced equipment? So, it, you know, it runs the whole gamut, but my biggest thing is just like, you know, what can we realistically do consistently over the course of a summer? And let's just do that. Like, let's do that. And because, you know, the worst thing is that you give them a workout that they don't stick with, and then, you know, nobody gains. And so I don't know.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Maybe I'm too lenient.
No, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's, as you're talking, I'm thinking about, advice that we give to people about exercise, right, is that you got to find something that you're going to do, because it can, maybe there's an optimal thing that could be theoretically better, but if you never do that thing that's theoretically better, then it's not really going to help you very much. And so I think that makes a lot of sense. do you envision using those days at the end of the season to kind of walk guys through some things that they could be doing on their own? Is that kind of how you're envisioning those days?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so just, I just have always felt like those year-end meetings, you know, kind of your exit meetings, so to speak, could be so much better conducted if you were on the court.
Yeah.
And so we're going to give it a go this year. We'll, I'll let you know.
Yeah, that's it.
I'll let you know how it goes.
Your second appearance next spring. We'll come back on and talk about it.
Yeah,
I like it. All right, final two-part question. Part one: when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then, second part of the question: when you think about what you get to do every single day, and obviously we talked a lot at the beginning of the pod about just this being something that you didn't really know that this was the direction that your life was going to take at one point. So what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
I might cop out here and they might be the same thing. So I have two sons now, ages 3 and 1. And so the biggest challenge day to day for me right now is just balancing, you know, responsibility to my family and, you know, responsibility to the program. And, I think anybody with young kids can understand, what that looks like and the time commitment and the emotional toll. And yet at the same time, I'm sure everyone can recognize the absolute joys of being a parent. And so, very, very much looking forward to the days. I mean, coming all the way back to the beginning of our conversation here, I mean, it's feel so fortunate to have had a father who was a coach and who introduced me to a game that I love and have now made a career of it. And the relationship with my dad is so great. It would be great without basketball, but it's definitely, you know, awesome to just have this thing that we both share. So the biggest joy in the years ahead will be, sharing that love of basketball, you know, with my sons. And hey, if they don't choose it, then that's fine too. But they'll certainly have every opportunity to.
they're going to get more exposure. I say that to people all the time. It's funny because yeah. I have a daughter now that she's a sophomore in college. She stopped playing basketball. She was in ninth grade and, you know, my son's going to be a senior and, hopefully he's going to get an opportunity to play some Division III college basketball somewhere. And then I have an eighth grade daughter and I'll have these conversations with people. And one of the things I always say is, you know, my kids, they kind of ended up in basketball, but we exposed them to tons and tons of things. But the reality is that because their dad was a basketball guy, they just got exposed to a lot more basketball than they got exposed to other things. So I think that what I learned, my advice for you, Jeff, is that they like what they like and they'll come to whatever it is that they end up liking. They're going to come to it on their own. But again, just because of who you are and what you do, they're definitely going to have, it's like you're throwing all those marbles in a paper bag and they're going to reach in and draw one out. Well, there's going to be a lot of things in there, but there's probably going to be a lot more basketball marbles in there than there are other things just because of what they get exposed to. So, and it's cool when they do, if your kids do end up, playing ball, it's fun to be around them and watch it. And just, it's a totally different experience as a parent than it is as a player and a coach. I can tell you that much.
Well, looking forward to it. We'll see what happens.
There you go.
Great advice.
All right. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share. How can people connect with you, find out more about you and your program, share email, website, social media, whatever you want to. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, great. I'm on Twitter at Jeff Juron, JeffJuron. My email, jjuron@suffolk.edu. And if you give me a chance, last thing I'll plug here is I help run overnight basketball camps during the summer in upstate New York and in Western Mass, follow through basketball camps, www.followthroughcamps.com, if you're interested in an old school camp experience. So I'll leave it at that.
Cool. How many of those sessions do you guys run?
We ran 8 camps this summer, including 2 overnight camps in August. So it's a busy summer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do some day camps. I tried to run a overnight camp here in Cleveland. We have a school, Western Reserve Academy, and they've been kind of bugging me to do an overnight camp. And I tried to get one going and just couldn't get it to get any traction. So maybe we'll have to have a conversation off air about, what you guys do to get people to get involved in that. Cause I've had a lot of luck with my day camps. I've been doing those for this summer. I think it'll be 31 years, 32 years. I've been doing those forever, but, the overnight one, I haven't been able to crack that one yet. So maybe I'll have to see if you can unlock the secret for me.
Anytime. Let's talk camp.
Cool. All right, Jeff, can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.